Welcome to the Lawyering Peace interview series, where we explore the intricacies of diplomacy and law in peace processes. Join us as we dive into discussions with individuals who have played key roles as diplomats or lawyers in negotiating peace. I'm your host, Dr. Paul Williams, the president and founder of the Public International Law and Policy Group, and the Rebecca Grazier Professor of Law and International Relations at American University. In this interview, I am joined by Betsy Popkin. Professor Popkin is the Executive Director of the Human Rights Center at UC Berkeley School of Law. She's also a Senior Peace Fellow with the Public International Law and Policy Group. And during Betsy's time with PILPG, she has advised parties involved in the Syria peace knot process, the Yemeni peace negotiations, and the Darfuri peace process. For a number of years, Betsy served as the chief legal advisor to the Syrian opposition delegation during the Geneva peace negotiations. Thank you for joining us today, Betsy.
Thank you for having me here today, Paul. I'm looking forward to discussing this with you.
Well, I think it's going to be a really great conversation today about your role advising the Syrian opposition. But let's start, first of all, with a little context. The Geneva peace talks were a years-long United Nations-backed international peace conference that aimed to bring an end to the Syrian regime's relentless attacks on its own civilian population. The talks brought together a highly eclectic Syrian opposition delegation to sit across the table from the Syrian government to negotiate an end to the conflict. And ideally, at the time, it was intended to design a transitional government and essentially a roadmap for a transition to democracy in Syria. The PILPG team, led by Betsy, advised members of the Syrian opposition on issues related to ceasefires, power sharing, elections, transitional governance, security sector reform, and DDR, as well as humanitarian issues. Betsy and the team also worked very closely with the Syrian opposition in the interim between the negotiation rounds on negotiation training and the development and the review of policy positions, and then the development and the critique of positions from the mediators or from the government. I also want to note that Betsy was closely involved in championing the role of women in the peace process, and in particular worked with the Syrian Women's Advisory Board. Now, with this context in mind, let's dive into our discussion. Betsy, I've heard you say over the years that your work in Syria was some of the most meaningful of your career. Can you walk us through the role that you played advising the Syrian opposition in the peace process?
I'd be happy to. It all started in the summer of 2011, just after the Arab Spring had started. And Paul, you probably remember this as well. We had our first meeting with a Syrian activist in our offices in Washington, D.C. on the day that the earthquake happened in D.C. So we were meeting with this person and, you know, just discussing kind of where he came from and his kind of first request, which was, you know, there was concern from those supporting the regime that they may not be taken care of under kind of a new leadership. And so the request was actually surrounding minority protections for minorities, how you could ensure protections for minorities in laws and in the Constitution. So all of a sudden we feel shaking. And this was just about a decade after September 11th, I think. A lot of people, their first thought, and we're on the top floor, their first thought was like, oh no, the White House. And Paul and I looked at each other and we were like, ah, this feels like an earthquake. But I remember continuing the conversation as we spiraled down the staircase, leading everyone else and out into kind of the street where everyone was gathered all together, because you know, earthquakes are not common in DC. Anyway, I hate to say it, but it almost seemed a bit like a warning of what was to come. But that's how it started, was working with individuals who were committed to the cause of the Syrian opposition being the protection of civilians and against the regime's targeting of innocent protesters. Then in 2014, so we continue with a series of writing memos for different representatives of the Syrian opposition, hosting roundtables in DC, Gaziantep, Turkey, The Hague. And then in 2014, the Geneva II peace process was launched. And this was led by UN Special Envoy and Arab League Envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi. We were invited on behalf of the delegation, the Syrian opposition delegation, to come provide support while they were in negotiations in Geneva. And as Paul mentioned, this included everything from preparing for the substantive issues to be negotiated, either through kind of in-person meeting briefings or through memos or through drafting proposals. You know, during that time, I spent time between Geneva and Istanbul when negotiations were out of session. I then, after the Geneva II peace process ended unsuccessfully, went back to a law firm I was working at in San Francisco. But during that time, we continued doing substantial work for the Syrian opposition in terms of advising them on issues that were coming up, whether it be ceasefire or in their negotiations and speaking engagements with the UN. In 2015, PILPG received funding to open an office in Istanbul to provide further negotiation support to the Syrian opposition leaders as they were preparing for a new round of negotiations. So I was invited to lead that office as chief of party. So I opened that office in 2015. Led it through 2016. And during that time, the Geneva III peace negotiations started, or what's sometimes called the intra-Syrian peace talks. During that time, you know, again, so we were on the ground with the Syrian opposition team. I worked out of their offices near the airport in Istanbul, and it was a combination of in-person meetings, trainings, proposal drafting, memoranda, accompanying them when they went to Geneva for negotiations, and sometimes, you know, going to see them in Doha or the UAE, participating in track two negotiations as well to connect up the track one and track two processes. We also hosted a big training for them in Saudi Arabia, just in advance to the Geneva III peace talks beginning.
So Betsy, a little bit later in this program, we'll talk about how you manage this global client, because just listing off all of the various places that you traveled to support the Syrian opposition in the Geneva talks is a pretty amazing list, pretty amazing itinerary. Let's hit on a similar point, though, first of all, which is the Syrian opposition delegation was highly eclectic. Culturally, religiously, ethnic identity, geographically, and then their positions as well in terms of how they visualized a democratic transformation in Syria. What did you observe or what did you advise when you were working with the Syrian opposition delegation on how to structure and maintain cohesion of such an eclectic delegation as you're going into negotiations against the government?
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I saw that worked best was informal time that members of the delegation spent together. So time over tea, over meals, taxi rides in between meetings, walks in between meetings, in between negotiation sessions at the UN. It was that informal time where they got to know one another, not just from like their positions on particular issues, but as people. I found those to be the most useful. And I would say from our perspective, we had a policy going in that we would provide advice and memos on issues to anyone who requested it. So there was no one who got more help than another, unless you know, one person sought out more help than another, but all of the different sections and representatives within the opposition delegation body, we offered the same support to.
Now, Betsy, a number of the listeners of the program are civilians involved in peace negotiations or members of a civilian delegation or even non-state armed actors who are also part of or who may soon be part of these eclectic negotiations. How did the Syrian opposition structure its delegation, and what rules or procedures or decision-making processes did it have in order to maintain that intra-delegation cohesion? Did they operate by consensus, supermajority vote? Did they not vote? How do you get, you know, whatever, you know, 36, 38 highly eclectic individuals to focus and agree upon a strategy and proposals to put on the table?
Mm-hmm. At all times, the Syrian opposition delegation had a head of the delegation, and the head of the delegation was oftentimes the final say in making decisions moving forward. We worked the most extensively with the lawyers on the delegation in understanding issues, analyzing proposals, drafting proposals, and basically analyzing agendas that came from the UN. So because we were lawyers, we worked the most extensively with the lawyers. We also helped to support, and we'll discuss this more later, but women negotiators. Some of the women on the negotiating team were most kind of in touch with those on the ground in Syria. And a lot of the issues they cared most about related to those on the ground in Syria. So that included detained persons who were being tortured in prisons. And that included humanitarian access to people who had no food, had no safe water to drink, were being attacked by chemical weapons. So we worked closely with different substantive experts to help meet their needs and better understanding not just the issue at risk, but also how other conflict scenarios have dealt with that issue and what some potential solutions may be.
So in the particular case, Betsy, of the Syrian negotiations, you had interestingly, from what I recall, the opposition that you were advising was generating proposals, ideas, you know, everything from the process of how the negotiations might proceed, as well as, you know, a proposal for a transitional governing body, a proposal for a constitutional mm-hmm. process, where the government was fairly intransigent. It was prosecuting the war on the ground, winning the war to a large degree with the support of Russia. How did the Syrian opposition delegation deal with this intransigence on the part of the government? And what was some of the strategic and tactical guidance that you provided the opposition?
So as you noted, the Syrian regime was not making headway in negotiations. And so one of the things we encouraged the opposition delegates to do was to make relationships with other actors who could affect the outcomes. So that included the UN. They developed close working relationships with not just the UN envoy, but also with other members of the UN team. And that also included building relationships with other countries who had influence. So the US was certainly a big one, but so was France, the UK, Denmark. And from kind of the more regional side, Turkey had a huge role to play, as did Saudi Arabia at points in time as well. So it was, and I should say that Russia was another country where at times was collaborating quite closely with the US and where the opposition could seek to build relationships. So if they were unable to build relationships with the party they were negotiating against, what are some other parties for whom may have influence over the outcomes that they could build relationships with?
So it was almost a multi-tiered negotiation. You know, the government sitting across the table, which was fairly intransigent, the mediator sitting perpendicular, and then sort of friends of Syria. I remember you and I would go to the French ambassador's residence on Lake Geneva, which was quite swish. and the friends of the opposition would meet and talk about how they could support the opposition, how they could pressure the government. And then you had the not very friends of the opposition, you know, the Russians and others. And Turkey was a little bit of a frenemy. They couldn't make up their mind exactly how they wanted to play the opposition, but they were all had to be managed and all had to be worked by the delegation.
Mm-hmm.
Betsy, on the topic of relationships, walk us through how you built the client relationship with the Syrian opposition. And for the benefit of our listeners, I had the bird's eye view to watch Betsy's amazingly talented approach to essentially finding a way to have these 2 to 3 dozen opposition members of the delegation all one by one come around to trusting her to give, you know, clear-eyed legal advice and strategic and tactical perspectives as well. And you don't just show up and say, "Hi, I'm your lawyer. Where would you like me to sit?" How do you build these relationships? And then I have a second follow-on question of how do you maintain those relationships? But I'll get to that in a second. But how did you build these relationships?
So I'd say there were a couple pieces of it in play. The first was being sure to develop and provide really good guidance on issues by the time you say you're going to. So they know that they can trust you to deliver, that they ask you, "Hey, I'd like a memo describing what are all of the aspects that need to go into a ceasefire that I'm negotiating. And I need it by this Friday." And you have by Thursday night delivered a memo that describes all of the aspects, and by Friday morning have scheduled a meeting with them to walk them through each of it. So a big part of it is providing what you say you're going to do at a high quality level by or before the time you say you're going to do it. And then another part of it is really just getting to know one another. And again, this goes back to the way that I, like the best way that I saw delegates form relationships with one another, if they had varying viewpoints on issues, was spending time over tea or meals or walks. You know, this, I think working from the opposition's office also helped because there was more kind of informal time spent with people. So really it's, you know, just the frequency within which you see one another and also just delivering high quality work product on time.
Well, now, Betsy, you just glossed over that a little bit, but I think for our listeners, it's something really to put in their mind's eye. When anyone would go, and I know this because some of my diplomat friends who were interacting with the Syrian opposition would say, "Oh yes, you know, we go to the, you know, the Syrian opposition headquarters in Istanbul out near the airport, and we meet, you know, all of the Syrians that we're working with. Oh, and then there's Betsy from California, who's, you know, has an office right there in with the head of the delegation, the delegation members." And it was really an integrated approach. Can you share with us a little bit how, you know, because, you know, most clients like their lawyers. Few clients actually invite their lawyers to move into their offices with them. So they're literally at their elbow whenever they have a question. And that's the sense that I had, is they didn't want to have you, you know, commute over from the PLPG space all the way across Istanbul. They wanted Betsy, you know, right there, you know, on site, because there was a constant flow of questions to you. But how did you take it from "I'm your lawyer, trust me" to basically having them ask you to move into their office space?
You know, I can't say what the exact moment is that it had happened, but at that point in time, we as a PILPG team had been providing support to them for 4 years. So a part of it, I think, was a matter of like the time that we had worked with them and gained trust, and as well as, again, delivering high quality work product. And so I think there came a point in time in time at which, you know, certain members of the delegation thought, I'd like to have you available to consult at all hours. And, you know, another point about it was, you know, different people would request different meetings on different issues. So being there on hand to be able to just jump into a meeting at the last minute was really helpful. And I think they also saw that as a benefit that, you know, if they wanted to talk to me about an issue, like this person can pull me in on this issue. So I think, yeah, it was probably building up those years of relationship prior to that time.
Well, Betsy, let's pick up on that second dimension of maintaining a relationship. You know, peace negotiations are really intense. It's they're fragile. Relationships are intense and fragile as well. And for a lawyer to maintain a client relationship with a highly eclectic and at times, quite frankly, a highly fractured delegation takes a real skill set. And not only did you maintain it, it was maintain it for a number of years. And you know, you were their go-to lawyer for you know the entire spectrum of the negotiations. What were some of the skills that you employed to maintain the relationship through those tough times?
I will first say the concept of attorney-client privilege was a new concept to most of the people we worked with. That's a very kind of American concept. So part of it initially was describing, yes, we may receive funding to be here from governments, but we owe you, like we can't breach your trust. What you tell us, we can't tell anyone else unless you authorize us to do so. So I would say that helped. And, you know, in terms of skills, I think it's going back to the idea of having kind of a trusted relationship and building a trusted relationship. And I would say another skill is just like the flexibility, having the flexibility to jump into any one thing at any one time. And I would say that was really helped by having a whole team back in DC that was able to work at the hours that I was sleeping, but also, yeah, just giving kind of me the flexibility to, you know, say, hey, what do we have already written about kind of presidential versus parliamentary systems, and having someone send it along, skimming it, and then 5 minutes later being able to jump into a meeting discussing it. So I'd say that flexibility was an important piece as well.
Well, also just to provide a little additional context for our listeners, and I probably should have done this before I asked these two questions, is I remember when you and I went to the first round of Geneva 2, the global community, or at least the friends of the opposition, the ones that met at the French ambassador's chateau on the lake, were all very keen on having their experts and their advisors providing assistance to the opposition. And I remember, I think on the first count, there were 18 different organizations from different parts of the globe that were all there at the request of their host governments to provide guidance and assistance. When we came back for the second round, there were only three. There was someone providing political advice, someone providing media advice, and then you and the PLPG team, Betsy, providing legal advice. The opposition had politely asked the other 15 to stop cluttering the playing field and to move on. And so I share that, and I should have said it before I asked the question, because it does really give a sense of how difficult it is to establish that relationship and then to maintain that relationship over time. Let me ask you a question we touched on earlier, Betsy, which is the global nature of this client. And we see this when, you know, when you're representing a government, you go to the capital city. But when you're representing a non-state armed actor or an opposition movement, there's oftentimes, or government in exile, they're oftentimes in exile, they're displaced, and they oftentimes have a substantial and important diaspora component, which is spread around the globe. And as you mentioned, the Syrian opposition were extensively spread around the globe. How did you manage that? What was your strategy? And what were some of the tactics that you employed to manage that client relationship on a global scale?
So when I was in DC, most of our clients at the time were DC based. And so that was an easier relationship to manage. When I moved to San Francisco, it was a lot of early morning calls and meetings. And then when I was in Istanbul and Geneva, maybe I'll focus on that because that was kind of the most robust period of time. We, like I said, we had a whole team supporting the work that we were doing back in DC. So I would take meetings with them like in the evening, they would take meetings in the morning. And I think it was the best possible scenario because they were able to get work done while we were sleeping. And so in particular, when we were in negotiations and working pretty much around the clock, it really helped to have fresh minds working on things while we were able to get a couple hours of sleep. And, you know, also while working out there, it was actually kind of the easiest in terms of managing the different client relationships because most people were based in Istanbul, Southern Turkey, Doha, Riyadh. You know, we had some in Paris. So I'd say people were all like in a time zone or a very similar time zone. And so I think having the clients in a similar time zone worked well. And again, kind of in having so many of them based in Istanbul and getting to meet many of them regularly was really helpful. But yes, at times it meant early mornings, late nights, but you know, that's what you do.
And travel to some pretty exotic places. Yes. Let me pivot a little bit. The course of the conversation, Betsy, and you know, let me ask you something that I think a lot of the lawyers listening, as well as a lot of the diplomats or foreign policy specialists listening, is saying, okay, when I hear lawyers talk, you know, they talk about DDR, demilitarization, demobilization, reintegration, or security sector reform, or the 15 core elements of a ceasefire negotiation. And clearly someone like you, Betsy, you can, you know, read this backwards and forwards. You know how to talk about very complex topics that are addressed in peace negotiations. But your clients, in particular, non-state actors, oftentimes, well, one, this is their first time that they've gone to a peace negotiation. Betsy, you've been to over half a dozen peace negotiations. It's their first time. And I don't know about you, but for me, I've never actually had a head of delegation who's been a lawyer or a peace negotiation specialist. And if I recall from our Syrian friends, at one time, the head of the delegation was an industrial engineer. Subsequently, the head of the delegation was a cardiologist. I remember at one time, the prime minister of the opposition was a dentist. Very smart, very intelligent people, but with zero expertise in peace negotiations or the legal dimensions of a peace negotiation, of a peace contract. What skills did you bring to bear to translate all of that brilliance in your mind to them so that they could be effective leading the negotiation delegation?
So I'll give you a couple of examples of how we approached it. So at PILPG, we do a few different types of things. One is a core elements memo where you lay out, you know, we're talking about a ceasefire. What core elements go into a ceasefire? What time the ceasefire comes into play? Separation of forces? How are forces separated? So you kind of come up with all of the elements that go into it. And so we would initially draft a memo. Then we would have the memo translated into Arabic. And we could do this at a very rapid pace. We'd provide it to the client, and then we would have a meeting with the client. And I think this was the most important part, is not just providing the memos, but having the follow-up meeting where you walk through, one, this is the first step. Two, this is the second step. Three, this is the third step. And we had interpreters there if necessary. Many of them spoke fluent English, but we also had Arabic interpreters who could help if needed. And I think in addition to the core elements memos, we also did comparative state practice ones. So I think for some people, they learn by kind of having at their fingertips. Well, everyone learns different. Some learn visually, others learn by hearing. And so I think kind of comparing, we'd have that. And then we'd also have comparative state practice memos, which provided examples for how other conflicts dealt with the situation. So you could visualize an example of how it played out. And I think being able to both kind of walk through the steps and provide like clear examples of how it's worked in other scenarios really helped. And I would add one more thing. We also at times provided decision trees. So, you know, if you are, you know, deciding what the like structure of the government's going to be. Is it going to be a presidential system or is it going to be a parliamentary system? You go like that. And then parliamentary system, bilateral or unicameral or bicameral, presidential system. You know, so it's a decision tree, which kind of, again, depending on how a person thinks, like that could be more helpful for helping them kind of think through the steps. So that's just a kind of overall picture of the general approach.
I also remember, Betsy, a number of times I'd be joining a conversation and you would be walking through the industrial engineer or the cardiologist. Look, this is what happens. You know, this is what happens next. You're going to go into the room. The other side's going to do this. The other side's going to do that. Or the mediators are going to have these expectations. And there was just that sense of comfort that you brought to the clients because you had been in similar negotiations before. And there was that sense of, yes, it's chaotic and it's crazy and it's stressful, but it does have a rhythm, you know, all to its own. And by being able to sort of let them know what was around the corner and let them know what was coming in the process, it gave them a sense, although it was their first time doing these negotiations, they at least knew that they had you at their elbow who had been through this a number of times before. And I also remember one of the things that you were quite adept at doing that they had quite a fun with is, you know, you're spotting the tricks that the opposition party across the table is putting on the table. And oftentimes the mediators are trying to trick you into mm-hmm. something. And then they would turn to you and say, Betsy, we need some bear traps. We need some tricks that we can put into the drafts, things that we can sort of try to, you know, outsmart them in the drafting. And I remember they were very impressed with your ability to to empower them to be just as clever and mischievous as the mediators or as the government.
The strategic piece was certainly the most fun. And, you know, yes, and that's another great point to bring up. You're not only dealing with the Syrian regime's interests, you're also dealing with the UN mediation team's interests and the interests of all of the international parties who may be supporting and backing either the Syrian opposition or the Syrian regime, but also have their own interests at play. So certainly kind of helping them to scope that and come up with strategies for how to address it was one of the, you know, most interesting things we did. And Paul, just also a shout out to you. You had many years and negotiations under your belt. So I know it was very much appreciated when you were at the table and to provide those kind of in-depth experiences as well.
No, there's just that sense of being centered at a time that is highly stressful for our clients. Let's turn now, Betsy, back to what we talked a little bit about early on, which is your deep, deep engagement with the Women's Coalition. And there were a number of women's coalitions, which there were women delegates specifically on the opposition delegation. There was a women's advisory council that the opposition had created. There was also a UN women's group that you had provided some assistance to. It included women from all dimensions of Syria. And then there were a number of women's advocacy groups that you were close to that were also present in Geneva on issues relating to sexual and gender-based violence, humanitarian assistance, atrocity crimes. Walk us through the role that you had in empowering women to engage in the Syrian peace process, and what two or three lessons learned that other women can use to ensure that they're represented, and then when they are represented in the peace process, how to do that effectively?
So I would say one thing I did was become very adept at international frameworks, promoting and requiring the participation of women in peace processes. So that included a number of UN Security Council resolutions, including Resolution 1325. And so that provided really the groundwork and the framework from which to empower these women. I would say another thing we did was really help to provide substantive recommendations on the issues that the women we were working with were most passionate about and devoted to. And I mentioned this earlier, one of them was detainees and the release of detainees. So we did quite a bit of work on what had worked in prior scenarios, what might be some proposals that they could put forth, what were, you know, there was particular concern with releasing the names of detainees because that had been done at one point to great harm came to a number of those detainees. So that was one issue. Another issue that was of particular concern to some was humanitarian aid and humanitarian access. And again, we helped both in analyzing proposed and past UN Security Council resolutions, but also in providing examples of how that has worked before and how it might work in Syria. So on the substantive issues as well, and really just, you know, we worked across the delegation, but, you know, our goal was to make sure that the women had at least as much kind of advice and from us on the substantive issues. I think oftentimes women are viewed as only being able to address like women's issues in negotiations. And we wanted to ensure, and they were at least as up to speed on a number of the harder issues, not harder, but, you know, some of the issues like ceasefire, which may not typically be considered like a women's issue. And in terms of lessons learned, I would say those women that approached it head on and weren't afraid to speak their viewpoints and their minds on things were those who were best received. Now, that's not to say they had an easy time all the time, but I'd say, you know, a lesson that I learned was, you know, don't be afraid if you're a woman on the delegation to give your viewpoint.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Betsy, because that's an important point. We oftentimes find that mediators will say, oh, yeah, let's bring the women's voice in when we want to talk about women's issues. And we've had parties say, you know, well, ceasefire, that's man's work. It's the guys with guns that negotiate a ceasefire, security sector reform, DDR. When we get to human rights, we'll bring the women delegates in. And what I witnessed in Geneva and the other places when you were working to empower the women's cohort was they have a view on all of these issues and quite frankly, stronger views on ceasefire, security sector reform, and DDR because, you know, the victims of the conflict are the civilians. And mm-hmm. That's who needs to be represented. And half the civilians or more are women. That's who needs to be represented during those talks, as well as during power sharing and natural resources allocation and things along those lines.
And many of them had stronger connections to people on the ground and wide swaths of people on the ground than many of the male delegates did. So they were tied most closely with what was happening on the ground and the issues that needed to be addressed the fastest.
So much less the diaspora viewpoint of power sharing. How many seats mm-hmm. in parliament are there going to be? Is there one for me? And more connected to their networks, usually through humanitarian or advocacy on the ground, mm-hmm. to, in a sense, ground truth, the perspective of the delegation.
Mm-hmm.
Betsy, let me pivot a little bit. You had a front row seat observing the UN and its mediation capacity. Generally speaking, what takeaway lessons did you acquire about how to be an effective mediator, or what makes an effective mediator?
So I think not having a perception of bias makes an effective mediator. So that means not just not being biased, but not being perceived as biased. I know that was something that came up while we were doing negotiations. And if you are perceived as having bias, one delegation or both delegations will have less trust in you. And so I think that came up as something that was really important. And that's just the first thing that comes to mind.
I do remember there was a distinct perception of bias during the negotiations, which undermined the ability of the mediation team to operate effectively. Mm-hmm. Let's pivot a little bit to skills. And as the leader of the PIPG legal team, as the chief legal advisor to the Syrian opposition, you were spinning a number of plates. You're managing a team of over a dozen lawyers. You're managing client relationships. You're, you know, being able to answer any questions. Is it ceasefire today, natural resources tomorrow, power sharing the next day? What were some of the skills that you found most useful and you would want future lawyers involved in lawyering peace, or future members of delegations, or future diplomats seeking to mediate? What do you want them to be focusing on developing now at the early stages in their career?
So both of these will have themes with what I discussed earlier. But the first one is the ability to build human connection. And I'd say that both in terms of building the human connection with clients, and really that comes down to time and their ability to trust in you and your work product, and also your ability to build human connection with international players. So with different envoys and ambassadors and people on the UN envoys team, and also your ability to build kind of connection and human relationships with your own team. When you're asking people to stay up late at night drafting something, they have to know you and they'll be passionate about the cause, but they'll want to do something for you. So I'd say that kind of human connection piece of it was something that I really have brought with me moving forward, and the necessity of doing that. And then the second one I also mentioned briefly already, but that's flexibility. You know, you could wake up at 6 a.m. thinking that at 7 a.m. you're going to be starting something. But by that time, what you intended to start could completely change, because something new could have come in from the UN's office and they'll want you to analyze that. Or Assad could have used chemical weapons on the ground in Syria and you need to draft something on that. Or it's just when you're dealing in a conflict situation and a peace situation, stuff is happening all the time that you have to be flexible with. I remember when I returned from Doha, I had been in Doha for several days helping the Syrian opposition to finalize their vision of what a future Syria would look like. And, you know, pulling late nights, I get in late, I'm watching a movie, it's about 10 p.m. and my phone starts blowing up with messages from friends on WhatsApp saying that a coup is happening. And I had friends trapped on a bridge. I had friends like out, luckily I was already home, but you know, I had to check on my teammate who was in Istanbul. I had to check on our interpreters. I had to check with you, Paul, in DC. I had to check in with the US, the UK, and Canadians, all of whom were funding our work. So that also shifted the course of how we did things moving forward in terms of like where you could meet, when you could meet. And so just ground realities when you're working in a conflict area or overseas in an area that is maybe less politically stable, and you know, they just shift what you could do. So the ability to be flexible and to adjust to what's thrown at you, I'd say, is one of the most important skills I've learned. And although I'm not working in a conflict zone right now, I can say it does help me to be able to, you know, wake up thinking I'm doing one thing, things come up, and I can easily shift things around to deal with the realities of the day.
Well, Betsy, I'm so glad you mentioned both the skill of being fluent in human connection and then flexibility, because both you and I teach peace negotiations, but we tend to, or our community tends to, intellectualize peace negotiations, and in particular, lawyering peace, the legal dimension of peace negotiations. And we parse out the core elements and the comparative state practice, and we have a sense that, you know, our job is to be technical. We can design an effective ceasefire. None of that matters if you don't have the human connections with your clients and your colleagues, and if you're not flexible to be able to pivot, depending on what's happening, literally, in your case, on the ground, when you get off the airport and go back to your apartment in Istanbul, and turns out there's a coup evening. So let me ask one last question. And this is, what one key takeaway do you want future lawyers, peace builders, members of delegations to know from your vast wealth of experience and knowledge? What is the one thing that you want people to remember from this conversation as they go forward and seek to build durable peace?
I'll provide it from the perspective of if you're negotiating, and I think this also helps from a mediator's perspective and from a lawyer's perspective who's helping a negotiating team. And this is to be unified, and if you can't be unified, to present yourself as unified. And so, again, going to the perception is key. And even if there's, you know, just a few things you can unify around, have those be your center pieces for how you present yourself. Because if you present yourself as unified, you will build more trust both among the mediators as well as international players and with the opposing delegation. So if there was one thing to take away, I would say be unified and present yourself as unified.
No, Betsy, that makes perfect sense. I do remember on that first round of negotiations, and this is probably what's kicking around in the back of your head, the chair of the opposition delegation made their presentation to the UN mediator, and the mediator said, thank you. And then someone on the delegation raised their hand and said, well, I want to make my presentation now too, because it's different than the presentation the chair just made. The mediator was like, no, you can't do that. You have to be unified, or I'm going home. So I'm so glad, Betsy, that you shared that one takeaway, because it's really crucial. You and I both represented highly eclectic, highly inclusive and representative delegations, but you still have to form a cohesive and a unified position, or at least maintain the external perception of such. Well, Betsy, it's been a real honor and privilege to spend this time with you, going down memory lane and being able to learn from you about the ways in which lawyers can contribute to building more durable peace agreements. And it was a real privilege to work with you and to watch you work for, you know, all of those years, both on the Yemen conflict, the Darfur conflict, and then your efforts to bring about a peaceful resolution of the Syrian conflict. So thank you very, very much for joining me and our listeners today.
Thank you, Paul, for having me here today. And it was great to work with you too over the years.